Duffy's Beer and much more in Pleasant Hills. 412-653-BEER. See all of our weekly specials at duffysbeer.com. And get your pumpkin and Oktoberfest beers before they're gone. Your South Hills headquarters for beer, pop, snacks, vapes, home brewing supplies, and all your party and tailgating needs for this week's game. Duffy's Beer and much more in Pleasant Hills and online at duffysbeer.com.
You already know that Invisible Fence Brand creates happier homes where pets can safely play in the yard out of danger. But did you know we also have products to help your pets avoid bad behaviors with trash cans, furniture, and unsafe areas both inside and out? We even offer a programmable pet door for more pet freedom. And expert installation plus professional pet training guarantee success. To schedule a free in-home consultation, visit InvisibleFence.com or call 1-800-578-3647.
Good morning!
Crib Live Radio presents the Morning Sports Report.
And this is my wake-up show. I'll be coming at you every morning. About this time, hoping to make your experience the best available in this price range.
An update and preview of everything going on in Pittsburgh sports. Now the Morning Sports Report. Trib Total Media. See what's next. Good morning.
Here on your Invisible Fence Brand Morning Sports Report, it is the 70-year anniversary today of the curse of the Billy Goat. And I don't like to live in my fears, Tim, but as you pointed out to me minutes ago, it's a good question. Do goats live past 70?
I believe the average age of a goat is 69 and a half, Ken. So
one day we'll do it. This guy could just stretch it one more day.
If they would improve their diets, they'd live longer, but tin cans get you sick.
This is amazing. 70 years today since the Cubs have been back in the World Series. Actually, I guess they were down 2-1 to the Tigers, and the goat was kicked out of Wrigley Field that day, and they then lost 4-1.
The game isn't being played today, so big deal.
Yeah, and Ken, you know what? Mario Lemieux turned 50 yesterday. That doesn't mean he's coming to fill in for Pascal Dupuis on the third line.
Well, you jinxed Pascal Dupuis, my friend. I listened to much of the show on my app yesterday, on my day away. And I tune in to hear Tim Benz suggesting strongly that a Penguins forward will be out for the, what'd you say?
I said that the Penguins,
missing significant time,
by the end of opening night or at least opening week, the Penguins would have a significant injury to one of their forwards. Because you know, all of this jibber-jabber we've been doing for the past 3 weeks about their forward line combinations was for naught, because these are the Penguins. Stuff like this always happens to the Penguins. They are always going to have an injury that is going to make their perceived number, their perceived depth at a certain position, all of a sudden become inadequate, because that's what happens to the Penguins. Their history injury is something you cannot ignore.
Jibber-jabber is a word the nuns used to use.
Stop this jibber-jabbering.
I'm often confused your spelling for a nun. Those tailgating nuns waiting for the Pope, maybe, but a nun nonetheless.
You know, I said it back way at the beginning of the even in the summer when we were talking, Ken, that I thought that they would get serviceable time. Either Kunitz or Dupuis would come back fairly like they were before, and the other one would not. I didn't expect both to be busts, and I didn't expect both to just not miss a beat. So this is bad news. I mean, this is, you know, a week would be one thing, but he's going to be out till the middle of November, maybe Thanksgiving now.
Yeah, I suppose we should give the news for people who missed this. And that is that Pascal Dupuis is out now 4 to 5 weeks, not just 1 week, with an undisclosed, the hockey undisclosed, non-clot injury. That's one thing they are stressing. But, you know, do you guys even believe that it's not related to his previous injuries?
As soon as I read minor, the first thing I thought is whatever it is that he's got needs to be amputated. Because the last time we heard something about a minor injury, I believe it was Sidney Crosby's minor concussion, which kept him out for about a year and a half.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, it was the lower body injuries he had, which was in part related to his blood clot things from the beginning, right? His knee issues, which he had, and the surgeries and the rehab from them and the healing of it. So, you know, not that Dupuis was going to be expected to carry this team, guys, and we could talk a ton of Penguins fans here before the show is done. I don't think they're in bad shape. I don't think their schedule is that tough out of the gate. They can get by without him for a while. But they are down another penalty killer. That might be the biggest thing in the bunch. They only have, really, between Bonino and, maybe Cullen, two full-time penalty kill players, and the rest are offensive-minded guys.
Yeah, down a penalty killer, Also, you take away the guy that can float between lines and float between wing positions. So as you're figuring out who best meshes with who, you can't take Dupuis and have him plug into whatever hole you create by moving. It's akin to Jung Ho going out for the Pirates insofar as when you were creating the wild card lineup, you could always know that you could put Gung at short or third and then move your pieces around that if you needed to. He's kind of like that for the Penguins.
Yeah, guy, and you know, more people were concerned about the power play last year, and it's special teams. That's really, it shouldn't define your season, right? Make or break one way or the other. But if you have Sid playing on the penalty kill.
Yeah. I don't know about that. I think if you have a predominantly weak penalty kill or an overwhelmingly weak power play, that very easily could define your season.
Yeah.
Especially since it's so hard to score 5-on-5.
If you look at teams going into the playoffs that have had great power plays, they're normally shut down or they're not as much of a factor as teams that have great penalty killing. Penalty killing is more important in the playoffs than the power play is. And you look at the problems they had scoring goals last year, I still think that their power play is a bigger regular season issue. But once you get into the playoffs, you know, I think the penalty killing is by far the more important of the two.
I guess so. Over the course of a year, you're going to have teams like 25% and teams that are like 15%, and it might mean 20 goals difference or something. It's not that big of a on the surface.
I think one out of three games it could be decided. Maybe in half the games are decided by special teams play, especially with the dearth of goals last year and from Christmas on, league wide.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, beginning of the year, we're looking at, you know, Penguins. We talked all year. How was their power play so good in the fall? What happened to it? Well, they were 3-for-6. They were, you know, 2-for-5, 3-for-7. Then all of a sudden, in January and February, they were 0-for-2, 1-for-3, 0-for-1. You know, the amount of penalties being called. It's not, you know, it's not just if you have a 33% power play, every three times you get a penalty. Sometimes in a game, you end up scoring power play goals because you get so many opportunities. It is so exhausting to kill penalties. It's the hardest thing to do as a hockey player. When you get a lot of them in one game, it has a cumulative effect. It's not just a mathematical equation over the course of 82 games.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's say Dupuis is out for, as they say, a month, month and a half. And that's probably before Fair gets back too, right? He's still out for...
No, Fair's not supposed to be back until Christmas.
Oh, okay, that long?
Right?
All right.
I thought it was mid-December, right?
I thought it was Thanksgiving. I thought it was late December.
Some holiday.
I thought
some holiday we'll be watching football anyway.
As long as it's not St. Patrick's Day.
Well, your third line is now, according to Jason Mackey, our Pens beat reporter, Perron, Bonino, and Bennett, with Farnham, Cullen, and Sprong on the fourth line. Is that going to be good enough? Is in a league where you got to have four lines that roll these days, is that going to cut the mustard over the first month and a half?
The only thing I don't like about that now is, what are you really going to get from Sprong playing with Cullen and Farnham? It was one thing if, I don't know if you were listening yesterday, Ken, when I brought this up, I really like the idea of, you know, dressing the same amount of forwards, but basically using Matt Cullen in the specialty role. You had your Laird plan for Sergei Gonchar. Good plan, by the way. That worked out great.
Well, wait till we see the power play, Bub, before you start ripping me on that plan.
Well, I know this. You're not going to see as many goals so long as he's on the ice. I know you wanted to never put him in a 5-on-5 situation, but that's not necessarily manageable. But at any rate, my idea was you'd certainly dress Cullen and you have him play, but a lot of times during the game what you would do is you would take turns double-shifting Malkin and Sid and put them in the Cullen spot and have Malkin or Sid play between Sprong and Perron. And I think that way you actually get the most out of those two guys, and you're in essence buying yourself an extra line that can score a little bit. Now with Sprong, who's an offensive player, playing alongside Bonino and Farnham, I mean, what are you going to get out of him there? Don't you? I mean, at that point, just put
that's an odd mixture of players.
Yeah, usually put a Brian Rust in there.
You put
or something
a fourth
at that
line
point
together, and it all kind of has the same style or the same goal. I mean, you got a rookie that's going to try to impress. You've got a guy that's going to try to bang heads. You got a veteran center that's probably not designed to play with either of those guys. But I also think that, you know, October, November, everybody else is fresh. Ken, I think the fourth line becomes more important come playoff time, or certainly as the year goes on or other injuries build up, than right out of the gate in October.
Well, that said, Golden State Warriors style, do you want Sid double-shifting early in the year and really grinding him to a nub by the time the playoffs do come around?
But if you double-shift with him and with Gino, you're really – plus you figure in power play time and things – you could do this in a game where there's not a lot of power plays. You just want to buy them a little extra ice time.
I think it's a good idea. I think it's worth looking at. But, you know, now, though, it doesn't seem quite as important because now you're talking about putting Sid and Geno between Sprong and Farnham. That doesn't seem worth it.
Yeah. How about Sprong and Perron? Like, if that's the double shift line, that's almost the top line, at least one you had last year.
That's what I said. That's what I said. If Dupuis was not hurt, you would have the opportunity to take Cullen out and put the two centers in place of Cullen there.
Yeah,
I think can't because now Perron's going to move up to the third line with Bonino because Dupuis's out.
If that's permanent, maybe Farnham can play up there. We'll see how it goes. Like you say, Guy, these things change the line combinations every night and sometimes within periods. But this also takes away, guys, their ability to trade for a defenseman, right? I mean, you had an extra depth piece here somewhere along the line, and probably now you can't afford to be dealing
forwards.
Oh, I don't know about
that. No, I don't know about that. I think that if you still get the right deal for Perron for a better defenseman, you make the move.
Really?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
I'll be surprised if there isn't, I'm going to say a major, a pretty big trade by the end of November.
If somebody still wants to take Bo Bennett from you, if somebody still wants to take Perron from you and they're going to give you a good defenseman in exchange, do it. Because not only are you getting Dupuis back, you're going to get Fair back too. And then you're definitely going to have a glut of forwards by the time the holidays roll around.
What's interesting, their October schedule, they play one division opponent. That's it, one. They play Toronto twice, they play Dallas twice, and they just play a bunch of Western teams. It is a weird October slate. So from that standpoint, maybe you guys are right. Maybe they can just try to treat this as, you know, not that important. These are not in-division games, which do add up to being more points when all is said and done.
Yeah, maybe they start off playing a lot better defensively than we think, and that, you know, part of what he does the first 6 weeks will depend on how they play. But they have to free up some cap space. They're so up against it, and I think they have to, you know, become more balanced. They're too offensively put together right now, and but like I said, maybe some of these young guys play better than we think.
Mackey, also our Pens beat writer, suggesting maybe Max Talbot will be a guy they should look at based on their penalty killing deficiencies right now. He was released by the Bruins, or put on waivers anyway. What'd you guys think about Max coming back?
Well, I love Max, but when you do get everybody set, what is Max if he is going to be playing on the same team with Bonino and Cullen and Fair? Isn't he a similar player to one of those guys?
He's a Farnham who's a more established penalty kill presence, right? He's your Craig Adams this year.
Yeah, well, they didn't like Craig Adams by the end of last year. So.
Okay, bad example.
But no, it's not, actually. It's a very salient example and probably the reason why they shouldn't do it.
Would you? Yeah, I haven't seen Talbot play over the last year, I got to be honest, so I don't know what
he's
got left
in the tank. Well, when he came to Boston at first last year after the trade, I thought he was pretty good for the first few games, and then much like the rest of the Bruins, just kind of flatlined after that and didn't add all that much.
Yeah, and, you know, and he gets along with these guys, we think, or at least it seemed like he did. You know, he and Fleury and some of the guys have good rapport, but that wasn't enough to keep Sergei Gonchar here, right? Just the getting along with the guys in the room. So, yeah, I think most people seem to be glad they went that route and cut Gonchar, even though he was a good rapport with Geno.
Well, your suggestion that we'll wait and see on the mistake or good move decision when it comes to Gonchar based solely on the power play is kind of unfair in the sense that they also sent down the second-best power play guy, or maybe the best power play guy. Like, you're going to say that you're going to determine
with Pouliot.
With Pouliot, right. You're saying that the success or failure of the power play will be directly linked to their decision to not keep Sergei Gonchar. Might I add, they also sent down their second-best guy, who's supposed to be their best guy in that role for a long time, and now he's playing in Wilkes-Barre.
I guess so, although, Guy, what did you think of Pouliot last year? Did you even on the power play, I didn't think he really bloomed yet.
Oh, okay, on the power play, yes, you're right. He still has a ways to go there. But, Guy, I think that it's not just about the power play with him. It's how bad he is in his own end.
Yeah, he's not going to be what you were envisioning Sergei Gonchar to be. He has to be able to be a top six defenseman. And right now at the NHL level, he's not. To me, it's the biggest disappointment of training camp. I mean, we went from, you know, praising Jim Rutherford for not giving him up in any of his deals to wondering if any other teams asked for him.
Right, this is the exact reason why, and we will debate probably throughout the season, compare their stats day by day. This is the exact reason why I didn't understand why they were so against giving up Pouliot for Saad, because I didn't think they were as sold on Pouliot as they were acting at that time, and this has proven that theory correct. if they were so sold on Pouliot that they didn't think he was worth trading for Brandon Saad, then he would have made this team, no doubt.
Or they wouldn't take Pouliot for Brandon Saad. You know?
Well, yeah, I mean, you're right. We're getting this from a Penguin perspective. We're getting some Penguin spin on this, but you know, a lot of that came from international writers as well, did it not? That Pouliot was the hang-up in the deal?
I think so.
Not just Pittsburgh people?
Yeah, and Johnston certainly likes Pouliot. I mean, we do know that, right? So it would make sense that they would want to keep him around, even if he's not ready yet.
Right now, he doesn't like him more than Adam Clendenning. So that's how much he likes him.
Although Mackey said he's going to be a game day scratch, he thinks. Like, he and Erickson will be the seventh and eighth guys. Does that make sense to you? That who would be the top six then? I mean, Scuderi is obviously going to be there. Lovejoy is going to be – probably Lovejoy is the one where – some people would rather see him benched than Clendenning in.
Yeah, it's awfully easy, I think, to scratch Ben Lovejoy. I don't think that has to be that big of a deal. I don't know that why that has to be that big of a problem if Clendenning's better. And I think Clendenning has more upside. You know what Lovejoy is.
All right, so tell us what you think of the Pascal Dupuis news. Out 4 to 5 weeks per the Penguins with an undisclosed lower body non-blood clot injury.
Lower body non-blood clot minor 4 to 5 week injury.
That's it. We're brought to you by Invisible Fence Brand, where pets can safely play in your yard out of danger when you get the Invisible Fence Brand way, and maybe goats too. I don't know. Maybe they got products that can help your goats avoid bad behavior.
Goat would eat through the invisible fence.
It just struck me when you said that. You know, when we said the minor thing, by the Penguins standards, do we have to, when they say minor from here on out, we have to acknowledge that these are Penguin standards of what is minor and major, right? I mean,
well,
they know what
concussion.
They know what a major injury is. So maybe if Pascal Dupuis does have a Ben Roethlisberger MCL type injury, ah, that's minor compared to what it could have been, compared to what it has been for Thomas Vokoun and him and Ole Mata and Chris Letang and Sidney Crosby and Gino Malkin. Ah, it's minor. This is nothing. We've been through this before.
Minor deal for Sidney Crosby, by the way. I see Darren Dreger tweeting that Sid has come to a 6-year partnership with Adidas or Adidas to become their only global hockey athlete, where he will earn between $1 million and $1.5 million per year. So Sid's overcome that minor concussion for a little minor side gig.
Adidas, huh? All right.
Adidas or Adidas? What are we going with here?
Adidas.
Okay. Schedule a free in-home consultation today at InvisibleFence.com. It's InvisibleFence.com. The Morning Sports Report here. Tim Benz, Guy Junker, Ken Laird. You guys talked a ton of Pirates yesterday. It was good chat. I encourage people to go back and check out the podcast if you missed the Monday show. I was wanting to weigh in, listening remotely to all the lineup discussions you guys were having, but I wanted to first start with our Pirates talk today.
If you're going to take a day off, do something fun. Why were you listening to us?
Well, I was on the golf course. So I was doing something fun, but I was listening while I was golfing.
I wish we had known
that. So how's that?
I wish we had known that, because if we knew you were golfing, as soon as there was a lull in the conversation for no particular reason, I would have screamed, "Four!" Just to throw you off of your stroke.
I shot 115, so you couldn't have thrown that very much.
115. I can't even count to 115.
It was a tough course. I'm going to go with that excuse. Anyway.
Tiger Woods is thinking, you know, that's not a bad round.
I'm a terrible golfer. Jake Arrieta is on Twitter at jarrieta34. He has responded twice to Pirates fans in the last 2 days. What do you guys think about this guy? Balls of steel. He first had tweeted to...
Balls of steel. Oh, no, I love to hear John Facenda saying that.
I'm laughing because...
They came into the AFC Championship game with balls of steel.
He didn't say that? I thought he did say that.
I'm laughing because did you see what Pirates fans did to his Wikipedia page?
No.
At the very first line, it says, Jake Arrieta, born blah, 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 eats balls. Someone hacked into his Wikipedia page and said, eats balls. So creative. You know, balls high in protein. That's why he gets such good leg drive off the mound, I guess.
Well, I think the thing about it is, I don't care what he says and if he's getting riled up about it. To me, he's distracted. If you're ready to pitch this game, why the hell would you care what fans are tweeting? I don't understand.
I think the same thing. That I noticed the same thing.
Yeah, somebody tweeted at him Sunday night, be ready for the sea of black, hashtag blackout, hashtag crowd is going to eat you alive. And he responded, whatever keeps your hope alive, just know it doesn't matter. And then yesterday, last night, somebody threw at him a hashtag we matter, which is not very good. But he felt the need to respond to this guy, David Green. David, bring out the reinforcements. I need it loud, in all capital letters. So not only is he Bob Gibson in the second half, he is brash on social media. I don't believe Bob Gibson was back in the late 60s. Maybe he is rattled. Maybe this is the way he works. It's pretty unique, isn't it? This is WWE like Hulk Hogan putting the hand up to the ear to the crowd before he comes in here tomorrow night. I think it's noteworthy, and I wonder if it could work to his disadvantage. Yep.
We've got a Cubs fan page that's following us on Twitter right now, Ken. Did you notice that? We are good. It's a Cubs fan page. Like, okay, everything's good. We are good. And they favorited your tweet about our Bucks and Cubs chat today. So obviously they're listening right now.
Good.
To what kind of balls Jake Arrieta prefers to eat.
I mean, it's
Rocky Mountain oysters.
Is it Jagoff material? Or are you impressed? I mean, I think
Guy is right.
I don't think it is. No, I mean, if you're a professional, first of all, I hardly ever believe any manager, coach, player in any sport that says, I don't listen to the talk shows. You may not pore over it. Then why does everybody get the red ass the minute someone writes a column that criticizes them or someone goes on radio or TV and says something about them? But responding to it, to me, just it just strikes me as he maybe isn't in the right frame of mind. I don't know. You would think he'd be so concentrating and just – because he's kind of a laid-back guy anyway. He's not the kind of guy – if this were Curt Schilling in the day or pick somebody that, you know, is a little more brash, you might expect it more. But I'm a little surprised that he responded.
Oh, if it was Schilling would be tweeting photos of the Nazis or something like that. With pirate hats on.
By the way, Schilling's replacement's in there because of that.
With fake
tonight.
Blood on his tweet page.
That's right. Heinz Ketchup is his Twitter avatar.
Jessica Mendoza makes her debut tonight in the AL wildcard game.
Oh, well, now I'm going to watch. Now I'm going to watch.
That's 8 p.m. tonight, Yankees and Astros.
How about CC Sabathia?
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, I guess if you got a problem, you got to get it taken care of, but don't you wait till after the playoffs are over? I mean, I don't know. Maybe I'm goofy for thinking that, for putting that in front of it. Did it really reach the point
it's
where
– just another week of being drunk. You've been drunk this long. Why not last another week?
Yankees look like they're a mess, don't they?
Well, you know what? I look at these two wild card games, and the Astros completely faded. It looked like they were going to win the division, barely squeaked in at the last minute. Teixeira's not playing, right? He's hurt. Yeah, you got a pitcher walking out with a liquor problem, a drinking problem, and as Tim said yesterday, was there ever a more nondescript group of Yankees other than A-Rod, who is a polarizing figure anyway? The National League game has two of the three best teams in baseball playing each other, with two of the top three winning pitchers in baseball facing each other. I mean, if I'm just a baseball fan and not a fan of any of these teams living in Portland, Oregon, you know, I might, go Christmas shopping tonight and watch the game tomorrow night.
I feel confident in saying that if you were to seed the Major League Baseball playoffs 1 through 10, or, you know, throw in the next two, make it one, however you want to balance it, and you went across league lines, you would see these three teams from the Central in the Final Four.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah, like Toronto
would probably be the other. I'd put Toronto in there with these three.
And I could see if they got it back to Houston, the Astros may be upsetting somebody over there, because Keuchel's just a different pitcher at home. He's one of the rare pitchers who's better in a less pitcher-friendly ballpark. But
he hasn't lost. He's 15-0
at home.
15-0 at home,
and he's like 5-8 on the road. His ERA is bad. Isn't bad. It's under 4.
And he's going on 3 days rest.
Yeah, so that plays towards the favor of the Yankees here. But, you know, the Sabathia thing with him, like, what was he going to be? He was going to be like their Burnett, right? If they got it to a fourth game, he was going to pitch like Morton a couple years ago. That's where he was in the slot. So it would only if they extended the wild card round into that depth would he have pitched.
I just figured if you've waited this long, unless, you know, I mean, I don't understand it because I haven't had an issue with that, but do you reach the breaking point, or can't you just say, this can wait two more weeks as it gets through the postseason? Might only have to wait two more days.
Something like that I hear, and I think to myself, something must have happened. You know, like he was about to be arrested struck a deal, something like that.
Well, to your point, Tim, about reseeding the teams, I don't know about the Cardinals in that, because they're 15-17 in August, Now, I know they played some meaningless games here the last weekend because they'd already wrapped it up.
You mean in September?
Since the end of August, yes.
Since
September to October. Are they ripe to be beaten? And I wonder, like,
I think they are. That's why I think this, honest to God, I think the Cubs or the Pirates, whoever wins this game, will beat the Cardinals.
No, yeah, I hear what you're saying, Ken, about that, but just look at it this way. Would you pick the Mets over the Cardinals?
I'd pick the Dodgers over the Cardinals right now. Based on those rotations, I think I would pick the Mets over them. I mean, Walker's their one. Who's their two right now? Jaime Garcia? Maybe John Lackey. That's a bad group. Yeah, I mean, Lynn's been shaky lately. That doesn't strike me as a team that's going to be dominant in a long series. Then again, they're the Cardinals, and they just find a way, I guess. But yeah. Just based on the reality of their rotation. And, you know, you guys were talking yesterday about whether the wild card game should be best of three. I don't know that that'd be any better for the Pirates, really, in this scenario. Would you feel better about their series to beat the Cubs in a three-game set where you'd face Arrieta and Lester in one and two than you would just to beat Arrieta once tomorrow night in one home game? This might be the best thing for Pittsburgh to not have a three-game or a long series with the Cubs. Because the Cubs, since the All-Star break, are 50-25. They're the best team in baseball. The best team in baseball.
I think they're the up-and-coming team in the division, too, which is why if the Pirates lose this, it may not be 1992 where the team's going to fall apart and everybody's going to go to the four corners of the earth. But, the Cubs have the money. They've got the young players. I think, to me, they're there a year before I thought they were going to be there. And I think, you know, they will challenge. And when the Cardinals get healthy, I think the Pirates slip back. I think it's the Cardinals and the Cubs next year, which is why, from a Pirate perspective, it's got to be the year. I don't see the Pirates being able to, with the players there. Of course, I mean, at some point we got to have enough confidence in Neil Huntington. He has been able to replace what he's lost very well the last 5 years, but they're going to lose a lot of people from this what has been a 98-win team. And if it took 98 wins to finish second, I think the Cubs will be better next year. I think it's hard to believe, but I think the Cardinals will be better next year. They're not going to have a string of injuries like they did this year.
Where I agree with you, Ken, is that, yes, whoever wins the wild card game, I'm going to pick the wild card winner to beat the Cardinals, whether it's the Pirates or the Cubs. I agree with you on that front. Where I disagree with you is where you said before that this might be the best thing for the Pirates.
I disagree, too.
Yeah, I disagree.
They went into L.A. facing Greinke and Kershaw and won 2 out of 3.
Because if it's 2 out of 3, then you've got to assume whether it's a wild card or 2 out of 3 that they have to beat Arrieta. Okay? And then what you're suggesting is game 2 would be Lester. So, okay, if they were to lose to Lester, then it comes to a game 3, and I like having Hap or Liriano in a game 3 against whoever their third best pitcher is. Hamill. I'll take Hap right now over Hamill or Heron any day of the week. Or Liriano in a game 3 in a decider, I will take Liriano.
I guess so. When you look at the lineups, we focus so much on the pitching matchup here. The Cubs have a better infield across the board, don't they? Every position, Cubs are better. Rizzo and Bryant are better than Pedro and whoever the Pirates play at third, Harrison. Their shortstop's Addison Russell. He's young, but I think he's better than Jordy Mercer, at least by the numbers lately. And I don't know about, second base. We'll see what Neil Walker does. But, Castro's been pretty good. He's been good in September.
What about the outfield, though?
I mean, yes, the Pirates have the outfield. Catcher, I guess, is a coin flip. Pirates are the better bullpen, but does that play in a three-game series?
In a three-game series, it does, but not one game, it probably doesn't.
One game, it could be Cole and Arrieta into the eighth, 1-0, and then the Pirates get two pitchers out of their pen that just hold down the Cubs, and they win 1-0 or 2-1.
Yeah, I mean, I just don't think it's an obvious edge.
The amount of relief pitchers that have been used in the 6 years of the wild card game, it's unbelievable. I mean, like 7 or 8 pitchers are getting used in these games because you bring guys in. You only have 2 starters and usually 3 at the most on your roster. You've got these extra you will situational pitch. If you got – Tim and I were talking about it yesterday, Ken, probably about the time you were like slicing one into the woods about, you'll bring in a righty-lefty. It doesn't matter how you stack your lineup. If the game's on the line in the eighth inning, you'll change pitchers 4 straight batters. So, you know, and the reason the Pirates' bullpen was so effective was its depth. When you're playing game after game and guys can't pitch three games in a row, you've already used your closer three times and he's out for this game, or your starter gets knocked. How many times this year have they had a starter leave before the fifth inning and even in extra inning games, and they get seven scoreless innings out of their bullpen, or five scoreless innings out of their bullpen, or a 13-inning game? That's where the depth of the bullpen comes in. In a one-game playoff like this, I don't think it matters that much.
Well, let me ask you guys this. How soon would you pull Gerrit Cole tomorrow night if they're trailing, if they need a pinch hitter, they're down a run or two because they've got such a good bullpen?
Well, down a run, if it's 1-0 in the sixth inning and he's pitching well, I'll look at the pitch count and I would be, if it's one run. If he gives up two or three in the first three innings, there's no tomorrow, man. Sorry, you didn't do it.
So it's 3-0 in the sixth. Arietta's got a one hitter going. You're pinch hitting Gerrit Cole.
Yeah, it probably doesn't matter at that point. You're going to lose the game anyway. But
what about you, Tim?
Yes.
You ready to pull the plug? So whoever, like, I agree with you guys. I think I thought this was a question in my mind at first: who would play, Ramirez or Harrison? I think you got to play Josh Harrison. I'm totally in agreement with you guys from yesterday on that, based on his speed and how hot he's been recently. And I believe that's what you guys said, right? I'm not to put words
in
your mouth.
Yes, that's what we said. And one thing that hit me, even as we were wrapping up the show and I was driving home, the conversation about who's going to play at third and how the lineup is going to be stacked was on just about every sports outlet yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
They only got Aramis Ramirez after Josh Harrison got hurt.
Yeah.
Right?
Yep.
I mean,
true.
A lot of people, myself included, thought they needed to get themselves a right-handed bat, but they didn't pull the trigger on anything until Josh Harrison was out for a substantial period of time. Now Josh Harrison is back, and he's playing pretty well.
Yes.
So if I'm Neil Huntington and Clint Hurdle, I have to tell myself that. We got Aramis Ramirez. He helped put a Band-Aid on the wound for a while, but we got him because we didn't have Harrison. Now we have Harrison. So, like, before Josh Harrison got hurt, we liked Harrison better, didn't we? Now we have Josh Harrison, so let's play him. And I like the notion of getting a good, potentially powerful at-bat off the bench more with Ramirez than I do with Harrison.
And that's my point. So in the sixth inning, Ramirez is your guy off the bench, right?
Right?
He comes in and gives you a pop if you need it.
And then you can double switch around it if you need to. You know, and then you can leave him in at third. You can put him in at first. You can put Harrison in at second for Walker. You can put Harrison in the outfield. You know, that might be the one area where we didn't really examine, where if you're trying to get Ramirez and Harrison in the game for whatever reason, you could put Harrison in the outfield for Polanco. But I don't think they're going to do that at this point.
Yeah, Polanco's not been hitting very good in the last month, right? I mean, he's been a 260 guy for September. But the arm, the athleticism, his speed, I think there's too much temptation to get him in the lineup, right? I mean,
not only that.
And the defensive liability of Harrison.
That's where
in
right field. Was he a liability? I don't know if he's a liability. That might not be accurate, but he's not as good. He's not as good as Polanco. And then what you've gotten yourself into is Harrison in right field, Aram at third, and Pedro at first. That might be your least defensively oriented lineup possible.
Well, then again, Polanco's had some flubs in right, too, guy, right? I mean, it's not like he's been totally clean out there.
Oh, I like for the most part, I like his arm and I like his speed, but that doesn't translate into always being a good fielder. He's a little bit like the newborn colt.
Yes.
He's out there wobbling around a little bit, just his entire game. I mean, at any point, you know, he can start to gallop a little bit and he looks beautiful, and then the next minute, you know, he's. I think most people know now, but. Like when PNC Park was first built and that scoreboard was out there, I don't think a lot of people realize that there's a chain link fence in front of that. That is a very difficult wall to play because a baseball hits one of those little squares in a chain link fence and can go anywhere.
Right.
And I don't think he is. Frankly, that's what I think. Someone should go out there and hit balls off of that wall for 2 hours with him fielding the balls over his head just to try to get a better feel. Clemente used to do that. The weird thing about the right field wall at Forbes Field. I always get the mixed up between convex and concave. I think it was convex. It came out.
Convex is out.
Beveled
cave
out.
Cave because you cave in.
Okay. So that wall
was like grade.
Mrs. Jones would be
That's
very
incredible.
Proud of you,
That's
young
Tim. Great recall.
And Clemente practiced that all the time. That ball could bounce off that wall weird. It couldn't really go under it, but if it hit under where the apex of the convexness is, it could bounce weird, and he became an expert at playing balls off of that wall. And I think that's one thing. If Polanco's going to be their right fielder for 10 years, he's got to get better at it.
And it's also the force with which the ball is hit. If you smoke one off the chain link and it still goes off the wall itself and bounces back, it plays like a regular wall.
But right.
If it's
almost the spinning,
like a long fly ball that comes down and like grazes it, it's just going to flop and fall on the warning track. It's not as simple as, you know, what people try to tell left fielders at Fenway. If it's over your head, turn around and play it. You know, don't run, just turn around and play it. And then you just kind of have to adjust to the way the ball – you're adjusting to the bounce of the ball more so than you are anticipation. It's a little bit of – it's tricky. That chain link does make it tricky.
Well, let me ask you guys this, because we've just been talking up the Cubs, or at least I have been here, and I do respect them. As you know, though, I've said this will be a massive disappointment if they lose tomorrow. It's kind of both for me now. Like, it's a disappointment because the Cardinals are beatable. It's going to be a massive disappointment because of the unknown of the Pirates' future. And you get another home game, and this would be two in a row you would potentially drop to them. But the Cubs are so good in the second half, and they're so hot, and Arrieta is so unbelievable here. I guess it's hard to crush them tomorrow or Thursday if they do lose the game. What do you guys think?
Well, see how they lose the game. If Arrieta pitches like Baumgartner did last year, well, then you tip your cap to him. If they lose the game 2-1 because they make another base-running mistake or an error causes them the game, then you rip them.
If Pedro makes an error and you put him in there and we're all in agreement that Pedro should play based on the home run potential?
Well, then I think we all
Then you rip Pedro for being a first-round draft choice in the top five and you can't find anywhere to put him and you don't play in the American League. Yeah, I mean, the thing that I think that Pirate fans should be the most potentially upset about is it's 4-3 in the seventh. They've gotten four off of Arrieta. They chase him. They go into the seventh inning stretch with Gerrit Cole in the lead, and then somehow their great bullpen gives it up, and there's a fielding miscue and a base running miscue along the way that allows the Cubs to come back. That's where I get upset. You know, the thing that they relied on the most lets them down, and the thing that snafu'd them more often than not in games that they lost comes back and bites them in the ass one more time. And that's
funny. Well, I don't watch the Cubs regularly enough to know what their base running is like, but they, like the Pirates, are at the bottom of the pile in errors committed. They're not a great defensive team either.
Mm-hmm. Let's get some emails going. SportsTalk@Tribweb.com. Some Steelers chat coming up in a minute here as well with all the news of yesterday. Ken Guy and Tim. Morning Sports Report brought to you by Invisible Fence Brand. Setner in North Baldwin checks in. He says, honestly, guys, I'd rather start Aramis Ramirez at third and leave Jay Hay on the bench. I think Aramis has a better chance of making contact with one for a home run. Yes, Harrison's been good lately, but Aramis has a better chance of falling into one, and I don't see the Bucks getting multiple hits to advance runners, which would suit Jay Hay more.
Well, the one thing that, you know, the discussion has talked about, and this is what Andrew McCutchen told me about Arrieta in the regular season, was, you know, the way he is so far right on the rubber and almost throws at you from shortstop is what makes it difficult for him to hit him. You get him in a stretch, he can't do that. So I disagree with that a little bit. I think the key is to get base runners on against him, have that crowd revved up, start thinking about running a little bit. As I said the other day, people get in a comfort zone. And when they have to do things that they're not used to doing, if he falls behind, which he hasn't been behind much, whether, you know, by score or has a couple of guys on, he hasn't pitched in a postseason game yet. I mean, part of the way he may be dealing with the nervousness of pitching in a game like this is some of his comments on social media.
Going after the Pirate Parrot fake account.
Yeah. I mean, you know, there's no way of figuring that out. I mean, I always talk about Eddie Murray in a 79 World Series. He was a rookie and had a great year. He didn't do anything in that series. I think he had a hit in his first at bat. I think it's the only one he got. I might be over-exaggerating, but he
that sounds right to me, actually.
Yeah, he didn't do anything in that World Series. And yet we've seen guys that, you know, that we've seen career players that have never really had a moment in the sun, and all of a sudden they're in the World Series and they're superstars.
Clint Hurdle won't speak till 2:15 today, guys. But I wonder if he'll reveal anything about the lineup. And is it any bit noteworthy that a week ago Sunday – Harrison was out of the lineup, and it was Ramirez in the cleanup spot and Pedro batting seventh against Arrieta?
Well, I think the argument about Harrison and Ramirez 2 weeks ago would have been more interesting. He's so hot right now. He's one of your hottest bats. I think he's got to be in there.
And in that game, Ramirez was 0-3 and hit into a double play in the seventh.
Ramirez is more likely to hit a home run. The Sentner's right, but he's also more likely to strike out three times, too. Harrison's more likely to put wood to cowhide. They're not made out of horsehide anymore.
And how about the idea of Josh Harrison dragging a butt and making Arrieta field his position? You know, I just, that seems so obvious to me. Is he's a lousy fielder. That's been an issue for the Cubs all year. The only way they got to him in that game the last time they saw him at PNC Park was getting him off the mound and running to first base twice, once where he flipped it and once where there was a, you know, a dicey exchange between him and Rizzo.
Mike emails sportstalk@tribweb.com, and he says, in regards to the lineup situations, not sure who I'd put at third, but I would lean toward Ramirez. The only thing Harrison has over A-Ram is speed, but he's not disciplined at the plate, which won't help getting Arrieta out as soon as possible, and Josh doesn't have much power. Let's just hope Hurdle puts out the best lineup he can. I can see Hurdle mangling this game. I don't know. Is there a fear of that?
Ramos Ramirez isn't exactly Barry Bonds when it comes to drawing walks. What's he got, 35 on the year?
2 weeks he's going to have a pipe and slippers. I mean, yeah, holy cow. I mean, he was a nice tourniquet when the bleeding was at its worst, but, you know, people are too in love with his potential power.
By the way, Andrew McCutchen has penned a new Players Tribune piece today, which just released. I have not had time to read it, but it's called Wild Night, and sounds like McCutch is reminiscing about the 2013 NL wildcard game and the first blackout, so worth a read at theplayerstribune.com, I would imagine.
Hard to figure if last year could have come close to that because it never had a chance. I mean, the Pirates did nothing at the plate. What inning did Crawford hit the Grand Slam, the third? I mean, you knew that game was over there. I mean, there was nothing. Yeah. The whole rest of the night was just like, it's going to be snowing soon.
Is this the best Pirates team of those last 3 years?
For the record, A-Ram has 33 walks since he came to the Pirates in 56 games. 33 walks in 200 at-bats, 196 at-bats.
Over the last 2 weeks, I crunched the numbers, too. He's got a on-base percentage A-Ram of 308. Pedro is at 382.
What's Harrison?
I didn't get Harrison. That's the most important one. I didn't get. I'll look it up.
47 relievers have appeared in the first 6 wild card games.
Let's see. What's that? Do the math for me. How many is that on average? 3 per side per game? Would you say 48 in 6 games?
Yeah, 47 in 6 games.
Okay, so 8. So 4 pitchers, 4 relief pitchers a side. What? Who's your long reliever in this game? Would you blow Jay Happ or Liriano if you needed to? I mean, as you say, it's kind of over if it's, it gets to that point, I guess.
Is Happ's arm ready after starting on Sunday?
I don't think I'd use Happ. I think Liriano would be my next guy.
I was thinking about this, too. I mean, not to look ahead because you can't look past this game. But whoever you start against the Cardinals in games 1 and 2 would probably be your games 4 and 5 starters as well, if it all worked out, correct? Like, let's say Cole pitches and wins this game. He pitched game 3 on Monday on full rest. You wouldn't need A.J. Burnett in the next series. You would just pitch Liriano and Happ games 1 and 2, and then they'd be back on for Tuesday and Thursday the next week.
Yeah, so you could shorten, rotation.
Yeah, so you could pitch A.J. in this game and not worry about needing him.
I think what you would want to do, though, is flip around the lefty-righty thing, wouldn't you?
I don't know if you want both lefties starting it off. The Cardinals have had trouble with left. We had the stat earlier. It was, you know, maybe a month. We were trying to find some chink in their armor, and their run production against lefties was I they believe, at the time, 30th in baseball.
Well, I don't know that they want to pitch Burnett in St. Louis, I guess. We're getting out of ourselves. I said we shouldn't, but...
But these are the kind of things, as they sit around and meet in the next few days, they got to be taught. You got to be prepared. You can't just go out there tomorrow night and, all right, we won. We got a game Friday.
Right.
You know.
Ramirez walks 15% of the time this year. Jay Hay walks 5% of the time this year. Mm. So, yeah, I mean, he's definitely more disciplined. I'll give you that. But let's not act like he's, you know, like I said, Barry Bonds. You know, he gets a walk 15% of the time when he's up there.
Next Monday could be Game 3 of the NLDS, Pirates-Cardinals at PNC Park, up against Steelers and Chargers on the West Coast. It's going to be that long until the Steelers play again. But I did feel like there was some noteworthy stuff that happened yesterday at practice, guys, that we should at least touch on it, I guess, here in our morning sports report.
Shazier's back.
Yeah. Return of Shazier and Martavis Bryant.
And I told you last week, after what Labriola told me on Wednesday night, they were targeting the San Diego game as maybe in the game after. Who's after San Diego? Arizona at home after that, as likely. So this is actually encouraging news that he's coming back 1 week earlier than anticipated.
And the news that Jason LaCanfora had dropped, that according to his sources, Ben Roethlisberger was set to return in Kansas City in week 7, barring any setbacks.
Dulac and I were talking about that last night on Brand Y on 970 ESPN, Ken. And
nice.
Dulac was hearing that it would be the week after that he would come back. So in other words, LaCanfora has him coming back for the Kansas City game, and Dulac was hearing from his birds in the air that it'll be the week after that.
A little more conservative. Yeah.
Right, and I would prefer that, especially since it always seems to be Kansas City that hurts him anyway, and they've got a good pass rush.
The week after that is the Bengals game at home, which would be
a
full Victober. Yeah, true. You might want Ben to get the kinks out a little bit in Kansas City, though, to prepare for the unbeaten Bengals. 4-0 Bengals. Told you about this, Tim. Week 1. Did you listen? Oh, no. Don't listen to Laird. Just mock and condescend
on. No, because, again, you didn't listen then and you're not listening now. It wasn't so much that that I was floored by the fact...
God, does this sound like dinner with my wife?
that you picked the Bengals to win the division, that you thought the Bengals were the best team in the division. I was all right with that inference. What threw me and what we had the big argument about was you used the Raiders as the barometer to convince yourself.
No, I used my eyeballs.
Did you pick the Bengals to win the division?
An expert analysis.
At the start of the season, did you pick the Bengals to win the division?
I don't know that we picked division winners, but
You picked the Ravens,
not.
Right?
I think I picked the Ravens.
You picked the Ravens. And then you changed your mind
because of what
you saw against the friggin' Raiders. So
yes,
you used the Raiders
of what
as the
I
litmus
saw.
Test.
As I picked Pitt to win 9 games based on what I have seen with my own eyes, you know? Sometimes you need to trust me. Trust me a little bit here.
I don't trust the Raiders as a barometer. That's all. If they end up being better than I thought, then so be it. They hung on and they were better than I thought, and you were right about them being better. But I just think it's crazy to infer that the Raiders were the reason why you used that as the litmus test, to change your opinion.
Okay, well, let's go back over that again. The Bengals will be a huge game in Week 8. That could be the division on the line. You got to beat them at Heinz Field if you want to win this division.
You know what, Ken? I look at that. They have 3 AFC games, 2 divisional games in a row at home in the first 3 games in November. That's the season. I mean, you got to be in the hunt when those 3 games start, but you got to win all 3 of them, especially with losing the first 2 AFC games that you've played.
Agreed, and then that's going to make it a tough decision for Tomlin and the doctors. When is Ben ready? Do you push him for the Kansas City game to get a game under his belt before that stretch, or do you make sure he's 100% healthy and you just save him for the Cincinnati game at home?
Yeah, I think a lot of that depends on how iffy he is, what the doctors say, and what situation the Steelers are in at the time. My own personal preference is let him get healthier. When Tim brought up all those numbers last week about how poor he's been in his return, the more I thought about it, I agree with Tim that he's tried to come back. That's more him trying to come back too early than being rusty. So unless they're really desperate and struggling by the time the Kansas City game comes, and you're just trying to save your season.
Which they could be, right?
They could very well be
2-4.
Absolutely.
What do we think of San Diego and Arizona now and their prospects of winning these games?
Right. That's exactly right. They could be 2-4, but him coming back, if he's not ready, does not guarantee you becoming 3-4. It might be closer to the fact that you are now going to be 2-5. I think that's what the history indicates, if he's not ready.
I agree with that. I think you made up a great that post is still up there at sportstalk.tribweb.com, by the way, from last week. It was a well-written piece. Part of me wonders, and I can't prove this, is whether you need that game to be good in your second one. You know, if the Bengals game is his first game back, I think there is some history that would suggest he might be rusty there and might be better served to play even if he gets bludgeoned a little bit in the Chiefs game too. So it's not a black-and-white decision.
No,
anyway,
it isn't.
Arizona lost to the Rams this weekend, which was a very bizarre result, I thought. The team that the Steelers beat and Foles is Foles comes back to beat and give Arizona their first defeat. I didn't see a ton of that game.
I watched a lot of it, actually. Yeah, I saw
great. What was the deal?
The Cardinals were moving the ball. They would die in the red zone. They made a really nice comeback. They scored a touchdown late to make it 24-22. I think they got the two-point conversion. And then after that, they had to kick the ball back off, and their defense came up big. Peterson made a huge play on third down to get the ball back, and they went four and out, and Carson Palmer missed a wide-open wide receiver on fourth down that would have converted a pass to move the chains and keep the drive alive.
Wow. And Foles had three touchdowns in that game.
Yeah.
So maybe Vic can beat him. I don't know. That is a home game. Maybe by then you hope Vic can win a game and you're 3-3 instead of 2-4 going to Kansas City. And the Chris Boswell era began without me around yesterday to talk about it. I was pretty upset about that. It's impossible to even like talk about the kicker with any degree of logic or prediction, but
Boswell, get your foot off the boat.
That's Spalding.
I know, but it's
that was my
Boswell
Nick Spalding
sounds like one of those names.
Well, is this a sign they're done with experienced kickers? They're going young. I don't know what to make of this one. I mean,
wow, I was listening to Jerry with Tim last night. He's talking about the infatuation NFL teams have with guys with booming legs rather than accuracy. And I guess he's got a pretty powerful leg, Ken, from all accounts.
Unless you're Justin Tucker and you're both, you know,
so powerful that he got cut by two teams in preseason.
Well,
or what?
Well, that might be because they were attracted to the leg until he had to start putting it between the uprights in crunch time.
Maybe they just don't want to pay another veteran. They just want to pay somebody as little as they can.
Next time I hear somebody say, oh, kickers are a dime a dozen, you can find one. Let's remember this six-week stretch here.
18 missed kicks over the weekend.
Yeah.
18. However, the overall field goal percentage is only down from 84% to 83.5% somehow.
We have on a number of occasions now suggested who should throw out the first pitch for inspirational purposes at PNC Park. It went from Jung-ho to Roethlisberger. I think the guy that would get the largest crowd pop would be Sweezum at this point.
Hartley was here for a week. He looked good.
Make it a chain. You know what I mean, Ken? Like, have Jung-ho throw it to Ben, who can throw it to Sweezum, who can kick it to whoever is receiving the ceremonial first pitch. Chris Stewart behind home plate.
Don't have Dupuy a penguin do it. He'd wind up with, like, Mercer or something from the turf. Pasquale Dupuy out for the year.
Well, next Monday you're going to have Boswell and this Lambeau who missed the kick that only the Browns, being the Browns, were able to pull him out of.
Greatest Browns loss of all time.
I mean, I guess it seems worse than it is, than the numbers say it is, the kicking, the status of kicking in the league. But point afters, the Laird plan, 17 of them now. We're down to 94.3%. So it's a full 5 percentage point dip after they moved it from 20 to 33 yards. So if Ben gets back here, Laird playing in full effect and Chris Boswell on the bench, yes? Can I get an amen?
Largely possible. I think it depends on score to a large point, especially now we're not talking about Roethlisberger. But I think they're going to lean more towards the two-point conversion now more so than ever.
All right, let's get some emails. We got a bunch of Penguins emails, too, so we'll get those in here. Brian M. says, first of all, guys, is Tyler Kennedy available?
I believe.
People were wondering if Letang could play forward. Since Pouliot is so awful in his own zone, maybe he could be moved to forward.
Most importantly, that would mean the return of Brandy Angle. So God bless Tyler Kennedy, but bringing Brandy back is far more important to me.
So his wife?
His wife and my former intern, who ended up being a model and a spokesperson and actress.
Oh. Tyler skated with
where
the
do
Penguins
they live?
Up.
Well, they were living in the Bay Area when he was playing in San Jose. Brandy lived in Mount Lebanon. Her parents own, well, they sold now, Mattress World. She's the one who does the mattress. You know the Vans with the blonde on the side?
Yeah.
That's Brandy. That's, her. That's Tyler Kennedy's wife.
He was skating with the Penguins up at the new facility a couple weeks ago at some point, so he's obviously keeping in touch. And by the way, Talbot is still skating with the Bruins this morning. He must have cleared waivers or is sticking with the team, so I guess he's available, but he is still in Boston. A couple people have emailed about him.
I'm pretty sure Brandy's parents cashed out with more from Mattress World than what Mario's going to wind up getting for his team. So that's probably why Tyler was here. Tyler, we're going home.
It's not in the Hill District, the Mattress facility.
Mattress World of the Hill District.
Less hoops to jump through.
Uptown Mattress World.
Matt says the Penguins don't need somebody to get to play the penalty kill. I like Max Talbot, but he's near the end. All the players in the Penguins roster have played PK somewhere in their lives. It's not that hard to learn how to play it. Could be true.
It's like special teams in football, and I don't want to undersell it, but a lot of it is heart and effort.
I think Sid could do it. I asked Malkin about it a couple years ago. He said he played it in Russia. He would be happy to do it if need be. Doesn't seem like it would be a great idea, but worth a try, I guess. Would give you some threat of offense the way Lemieux used to do at the top of the PK. Brian W. says Talbot's awful, guys. He can't play anymore. Don't recycle that clown. Cullen could move to wing. They could double shift the center with Cullen on the left and Sprong on the right would be my approach.
That may be true, and I tend to agree that I would never call a guy that scored two goals to win you a Stanley Cup against improbable odds a clown.
Yeah, that's a good point. Hard to hear that. Surprised to see that. All right, Killer Chihuahua wants to talk about the blown call last night.
Oh, the batted ball.
The
Ziggy Hood rule.
People missed the Monday night game. Detroit got screwed, sort of, although Calvin Johnson fumbled at the one at the essence of this play. But do you have the rule handy there, Tim? This is just, you're not allowed to bat the ball as a defensive player anywhere in the end zone.
Ziggy and the special teams for the Steelers, they blocked that field goal against Green Bay the last time they were there. And as it was flopping around, Ziggy tried to bat it forward and it bounced out of bounds. So they blocked the kick, and then they ended up having to give the ball back to Green Bay. I believe Green Bay scored a touchdown after that, but the Steelers still ended up winning.
The bigger discussion on that play was whether Ryan Clark had maintained possession, which was not a reviewable thing at the time, right? And then after Clark had tried to lateral it, Ziggy Hood, for some reason, batted it, to nobody's knowledge of why, out of bounds. But anyway, in this play, Detroit fumbled, rather.
Cam Chancellor came and ripped it out of Calvin Johnson's hands as he was leaning towards the pylon.
Right, and Seattle's player in the end zone batted it through the back of the end zone because he didn't want it to be recovered, but unfortunately that's illegal. But the referee who was watching it didn't find it to be an egregious enough bat, I guess.
Well,
anyway,
I have no idea
how he blew that rule. I don't know how you look at that and say that was incidental or it was an attempt to recover the ball. I have no friggin' clue. And you know what? Neither does the ref, because the ref, that was the excuse that he used. And Blandino called him out on it and said that the refs screwed up the call.
Right. Chihuahua says, this is a dumb rule, but it's a rule, and the announcers on ESPN were not aware of the rule, and neither were the coaches, players, and most importantly, the refs. That is a botched call which cost me a fantasy win. We, the public, watch, gamble, and play fantasy sports based on a league which nobody knows the rules.
Amen, Chihuahua.
We is dumb is the way Chihuahua ends that one.
Hashtag we is dumb. He should write another song about that because he's spot on. Rule 12, Section 4, Article 1. I found it, Ken. It is an illegal bat if a player of either team bats or punches a loose ball that has touched the ground in any direction if it is in either end zone. Penalty. If the foul is by defense, it is an automatic first down.
That just says
the end zone. I don't know why it's just the end zone, because the Ziggy play was in the middle of the field. Not the middle of the field, but it was in the field of play.
Yeah, the other thing about that Steelers play was the ball didn't go past the line of scrimmage, which was key to it right as well, because then the Packers could have picked it up and scooped it up and scored. So there are a lot of weird rules. I mean,
Well, that's more about a kick, though, right?
Yeah, that's a kick that didn't go past the line of scrimmage. But anyway.
Right, because if it goes across the line of scrimmage, then it basically becomes the Leon Lett play.
Right.
But if it stays behind the line of scrimmage, yes, then the Packers could scoop and score it.
Which was why Ryan Clark was trying to get it, I guess, and I guess why Ziggy Hood was trying to get it out of bounds so they wouldn't recover it. But the rule book is thick. It's complicated. Should the refs be accountable for knowing every rule?
Yes.
And
yes.
A bottom line, yes,
yeah, answer,
right?
Yeah.
It's their job.
They make great money.
They do. They're not full-time yet, are they? I mean, a lot of these guys do work in the off-season, but
it's... That's too bad. You're getting paid $5,000, $7,000 a game, whatever it is they're getting, $3,000 a game.
Yeah, this is a different argument, in my opinion, than the, for instance, the rule that we debated last week when it comes to Roethlisberger and the injury, whether or not a flag should have been dropped in the Rams for leg diving on the quarterback. You know, that is a rule that is poorly written because it contradicts itself. And you as a referee are looking for something, you interpret it a certain way, you do or you do not drop a flag.
It's a lot more judgmental than what we're talking about here.
This one, you can't get more obvious. The guy punched it out of the end zone and applauded himself. KJ Wright swatted at it, then gave a fist pump like, yeah, that was the smart thing to do. He thought he was being smart because he didn't know the rule. He thought if I just knock it out of the end zone, then it's a dead ball. What he thought he was going to screw up was jumping on the ball, having it squirt out from underneath him, and then the Lions jumping on it and having it be a touchdown. So he thought he was making a heady play, when in reality what he was doing was giving the ball to Detroit on the half-yard line by doing so. And you know what? That's the same end zone where the fail Mary occurred with the replacement refs. That's the great irony of this.
Yeah, Seattle's just not the place to go for great officiating.
The same place that inspired the moment of the regular refs being applauded with standing ovations across the National Football League, nearly the same spot in the end zone, this debacle takes place with the real refs.
Well, faith in gambling, that's what it's all about. Coming up on the program here, a major potential scandal in the DraftKings FanDuel world.
Oh, I like this story.
Which will possibly affect your faith on these leagues. Should, I think.
Also, can we get back to hockey a little bit before I take off at 11:30? Because there's a couple hockey items I want to get to, including something really bizarre that play-by-play man Mike Lang said yesterday. And we got to get to that Rafi Torres suspension, too.
Big suspension. Definitely, we'll do that. Get a little hockey fixed in. Tim Benz, Guy Junker, Ken Laird. We're all brought to you here on the Morning Sports Report by Invisible Fence Brand. Don't forget your free consultation at InvisibleFence.com. Free in-home consultation. Help your pets avoid bad behavior with all great kind of things, including the programmable pet door for more pet freedom, creating happier homes where pets can play safely in the yard and out of danger. Mark Cabali talks Steelers with us at 11:30. Mike Tomlin presser at noon. Ken, Guy, and Tim, and we'll talk some hockey on the way.